Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gatehouse Florida. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, and I'm joined as always by Gatehouse Florida Capitol correspondent John Kennedy. Hey, John.
Hi, Zach.
Well, Florida Democrats are trying to force a special legislative session on guns. Senator Marco Rubio now says climate change is a real problem, and Florida will soon be joining a national voter registration system. We'll be talking about all of that, but first, you all know what that music means. It's time for Pick a Number. I'll start off today. I'm coming in with a 34.2. As George Bennett used to say, decimal points are allowed in Pick a Number. John, do you have your number ready?
I sure do. Zach, last week I broke the bank by picking a number that was up in the hundreds of millions, but this week I'm kind of back to earth. I'm in single digits again, and my number is 8.
8. All right. Both of us with some modest choices this time around. So write those numbers down. I have a 34.2. John Kennedy has an 8. We'll come back to those at the end of the show and tell you what they mean for Florida politics. Well, Florida Democrats might have a hard time getting the GOP-controlled legislature to vote on gun control bills, but at least they can get a vote on whether to convene a special session to address the gun violence issue. This week, Democrats forced a special session vote by getting more than 40 lawmakers, or 20% of the legislature, to send in letters requesting the special session. Now, every member of the legislature must vote on the issue. John, you wrote about this parliamentary maneuver by Democrats. I'm wondering what they're doing here. Republicans aren't going to hold a special session on guns. The state's GOP leadership has said as much. So is this just a publicity stunt? Are Democrats trying to show their base that they're trying to do something on this gun issue? Or is this also maybe an election year strategy to try and put Republicans on record and make them seem unwilling to consider reasonable gun reforms?
Yeah, well, all of the above could be true. You know, Democrats have tried similar efforts, unsuccessfully, following the Pulse nightclub shootings in 2016 and again last year when they wanted a special session to steer more money to public schools. So you kind of wonder, you know, why bother? Well, first off, Democrats seriously want to address gun violence in this state, and the Republican legislature has rarely allowed any kind of discussion of guns. In fact, last year after Parkland, the school security legislation that was approved, that included raising the age to buy guns to 21 from 18, and a ban on bump stocks, which allows guns to fire more rapidly. Those were really the first gun limits approved in Florida in 30 years. Now we spoke last week about Senate President Bill Galvano, who, you know, he is a Republican from Bradenton, that he wants his Senate to begin next month examining what he sees as the causes behind mass shootings. He says he wants an open discussion, everything on the table. So presumably that would mean some level of discussion on things like a ban on assault weapons and enhanced background checks as well. But Democrats think, you know, probably not, that those things will find a way not to emerge during any kind of discussion in the Senate, at least not a sincere discussion as they look at it. So the Democrats are basically, you know, upping the stakes on Galvano and his plans for a Senate analysis by attempting this special session. Now, of course, the political component of all this, as there always is in Tallahassee, is that with an election year ahead, Democrats can use this undoubtedly failed attempt to hold a special, the whole idea of trying to hold a special session, it will become something that it's another sign of Republicans being beholden to the National Rifle Association at a time when polls seem to suggest that people are ready for some kind of response to this spate of mass shootings. But, the Democrats in their letters to the Secretary of State in calling for the special session, they highlighted the vulnerability of Hispanic Floridians to gun violence. They cited how the man accused of this month's shooting at the El Paso Walmart told police that he was targeting Mexicans. So the response to guns now has this added political component of trying to cast Florida Republican leaders as ignoring a threat to Hispanic residents, a voting bloc that may already feel, you know, kind of uneasy about the party in this state under that controversial new law that requires local governments to assist federal immigration and customs enforcement agents in detaining immigrants who commit crimes. That's that, you know, sanctuary cities ban that we've spoken so much about. It's still a very raw nerve in many parts of Florida, and Democrats can now attempt to add, you know, Republican resistance to addressing gun safety as something that Hispanic voters can be sensitive to and can question whether Republicans really have their best interest in heart. So, you know, will all this work? It really seems that elections are, you know, really mosaics where piece by piece, a picture of what a party and its candidates are is put together in the minds of voters based on moments that are important to those voters. Will the mass shootings that killed 31 people in Ohio and Texas have resonance, you know, going into next year? On a national level, congressional Democrats are likely to be sounding similar themes about guns and drawing contrasts with Republicans when Congress resumes after the August recess ends, you know, soon after Labor Day. So I think this issue is going to probably stay hot, at least, you know, well into the fall right now.
Yeah, and the reality is that if you're a Democrat or anybody else who is concerned about gun violence and the spate of mass shootings in Florida, and you believe the problem is guns and the easy access to guns, your options are pretty limited here in Florida. You know, if you're a Democratic lawmaker, you can file a bill to try and ban assault weapons or expand background checks, but the legislature, you know, the GOP leadership is probably not even going to hold any hearings on these bills, so they're not going to get a lot of attention other than maybe when you file them. You can do demonstrations in the Capitol. You can try and hold some rallies. There's a rally here in Sarasota on Sunday where gun control advocates are trying to attract some attention to this issue. And this idea of forcing a vote on a special session, to me, just seems like another avenue for them to try and get a little bit of attention, keep the pressure on, keep this issue in the spotlight as we go into the next lawmaking period and the next election period here. But a special session on guns isn't going to happen. But there was some action this week on another big issue in Florida politics, and that's the security and integrity of our elections, which seems to be an issue nearly every election cycle. This week, Governor Ron DeSantis announced that the state will join an election program known as ERIC, which stands for Electronic Information Research Center. Florida will become the 29th state to join this group. John, this is another issue that you wrote about this week. What is this organization and what does joining it mean for Florida's electoral process?
Yeah, well, Florida is going to join this Electronic Information Research Center, ERIC. It's going to become the 29th state along with the District of Columbia that are part of this exchange. That's basically intended to help states track registration data, reduce the number of voters that are registered in more than one state, and you know, be able to kind of clean voter rolls of deceased voters, you know, whose names, you know, linger on these rolls well after their demise. DeSantis, he went to Orlando to the Orange County Supervisor of Elections office to make this announcement, and he says, you know, all the supervisors think that this makes sense for us. And they basically do. This is a significant move by DeSantis because election supervisors across the state have been clamoring to join this ERIC system for several years. And DeSantis's predecessor, now U.S. Senator Rick Scott, just didn't do it. One of the elements to join ERIC that still has to be done is that a mass mailing must be sent to an estimated about 4.2 million Floridians who are eligible to vote but currently not registered. That's going to cost about $1.3 million, and DeSantis still has to get the legislature to okay that. But if you're a political cynic or maybe just a realist and watch the many ways in recent years that Florida Republican lawmakers have found ways to limit voting access, this mass mailing may be something that Republicans fear will, you know, add more likely Democratic voters to the rolls. We've spoken in earlier editions of Inside Florida Politics about the ongoing battle over Amendment 4. That's the constitutional amendment approved last year by Florida voters that clears the way for as many as 1.5 million disenfranchised former felons to regain their voting rights. And as we've mentioned, a new law implementing this amendment and signed by DeSantis is now being challenged in federal court because it allows these people to register only after paying all their financial obligations. Campaigns are underway to reach out to these ex-felons with information about what they need to do to register for next year's elections. So that issue is also part of this, you know, voter rolls landscape that's out there right now. Joining Eric, though, seems generally to be kind of a good government thing to do in a state like Florida, where a lot of people live part of the year, you know, or they move here. There are plenty of people who may ultimately register to vote in the state, even while they're still registered to vote in another state. And they don't notify their supervisors there that they should be taken off the rolls. So, you know, this is something that the election supervisors can get a little bit better handle on, you know, who should and should not be on their voter rolls. So, you know, amid fears about voter fraud that are often fanned by Republicans, President Trump and Florida's Rick Scott are among them, this new partnership should help soften those complaints. Now for DeSantis, I think he just doesn't want to see the 2020 election go into a ditch in Florida. I think, you know, remember, he's the winner of the closest governor's race in Florida history, which needed a machine recount. So he knows that the credibility of the election system and voter rolls are an important part of maintaining public confidence. And it wasn't too long ago now, too, this year, that Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report on Russian interference in the 2016 election also included a reference to emails sent to accounts used by Florida elections officials and employees of technology vendors. DeSantis in May said that election systems in two Florida counties were targeted for hacking by these, you know, Russian interferers, but he added that he was barred from identifying them after he had signed a non-disclosure agreement demanded by the FBI. So, you know, that's still a cloud over the whole system. And now, earlier this summer, he also sent $2.3 million, roughly, in leftover money that came from a $19 million federal grant that was distributed last year. He has sent that $2.3 million back to counties to help with any needed cybersecurity improvements. So I think DeSantis is trying to make sure that things just don't get hinky on his watch. And as a protege of the president, who, you know, is likely to face a very tight reelection campaign, especially in Florida, the biggest of the states up for grabs, I think Governor DeSantis, he may be just trying to make sure that his own place in history doesn't include some massive election controversy.
John, you made a lot of good points there, but I think one thing that's important to highlight is that this joining Eric really does have broad support. This is supported by good government groups. It has bipartisan support. In the past, when we've talked about cleaning the voter rolls, the idea of voter purges has come up. It's been viewed as in a partisan manner to some degree, that people were maybe being taken off the rolls who shouldn't have been, and that you know, that it was targeting voters who might be more, you know, Democratic leaning. Rick Scott got some controversy over this, but this is not that. Nobody's accusing this group of, you know, trying to purge anybody. This is just voter roll maintenance, trying to make sure that you have very clean voter rolls, because there is a lot of people in Florida who come from other states and might be registered in other states and just not realize that they're registered in both states. And you mentioned that this could actually take away some of the GOP argument that there's a lot of election fraud. And it could actually get more people registered, which a lot of the people that aren't registered are, you know, tend to be these infrequent voters who aren't as interested in politics and tend to be maybe more Democratic leaning. So on the whole, you know, there could be some political ramifications from this that that aren't, you know, entirely, like if you were just a Republican who was only looking at, is this going to help us come election time? You might not pursue this if it was just purely political. But you're saying DeSantis, you think that he really wants to avoid any controversy and just make sure that this is one issue where, you know, you're not going to have a lot of headlines of problems with the voter rolls.
Sure. Like that. Yeah, I do think, you know, he has his own reputation to you know, monitor and watch right now. I think he would hate to be the governor of a state that became, you know, the way Florida was in 2000 under Jeb Bush during that contested, you know, recount in a presidential election. And given the way the numbers seem to be falling across the electoral map, I mean, Florida could be pretty decisive in the 2020 presidential race. And, you know, DeSantis basically owes his governorship to a great degree to a couple of very favorable tweets that were endorsements from President Trump last year as he headed into a very contested Republican primary. So there's no doubt that there is a bond between the Florida governor and the Republican president. So it would be a very difficult spot politically for him to be in if he is trying to protect a electoral victory in Florida by President Trump amid, you know, allegations that there's been all kinds of electoral fraud going on during the campaign.
Well, Lord knows we don't need any more election controversy in Florida. We've had more than our fair share, and yeah, there's plenty of other controversies. One of those being the issue of climate change, which is always a major topic of discussion. And U.S. Senator Marco Rubio weighed in this week. He attracted some attention for an op-ed that he wrote for USA Today about climate change. In the article, Rubio said that climate change is, quote, a real problem, and that, quote, Floridians are right to be concerned about the changing climate. And that's noteworthy because it contrasts with President Trump, who has called climate change a hoax. Rubio himself has also been somewhat dismissive of climate science in the past. He has questioned the extent that humans are contributing to climate change. Here's what Rubio told ABC's John Carl in 2014.
But let me get this straight. You do not think that human activity, the production of CO2, has caused warming to our planet?
I do not believe that human activity is causing these dramatic changes to our climate the way these scientists are portraying it.
So there you see Rubio kind of downplaying the role that humans have in contributing to global warming. But his latest op-ed seems to reflect a different view. He talks about, quote, our past climate sins, which seems to imply that humans have been altering the climate. But what's really interesting is Rubio's position on how to respond to climate change, and that hasn't changed. He continues to reject any aggressive efforts to curb carbon emissions from activities such as burning fossil fuels. These emissions are creating a greenhouse gas effect that warms the planet, but Rubio says in his op-ed that, quote, attempting to reverse engineer the U.S. economy to absolve our past climate sins, either through a carbon tax or some Green New Deal scheme, will fail. He goes on to say that, quote, plans stemming from panic will constrain our economy and cripple our ability to invest future resources in solving long-term issues. John, Rubio seems to want to have his cake and eat it too, in a sense. He seems to be acknowledging that climate change is a big problem, thereby avoiding the label of climate denier, but at the same time arguing we really can't do anything about it. We should just figure out ways to adapt to the problem, like addressing things like sea level rise and flooding and hardening our infrastructure, things like that. What do you make of Rubio's position here?
Yeah, his adaptation message is kind of a complicated one for many people, I think. In his op-ed, Rubio, I think he's trying to position himself as a smart thinker, a problem solver, who is cautious about setting wide-ranging goals like the Green New Deal, which he sees as potentially undermining the economy. He acknowledges that Americans, particularly Floridians, are right to be concerned about climate change, but they are also right, he says, to be concerned about what he calls a regressive overreaction. But his solution, that adaptation by society is the answer, it's really just left himself open to be mocked by people who think that, you know, more dramatic steps are needed given the rapid changes that we are seeing that appear to be linked to climate change. You know, in his defense, he cites his role in getting the Central Everglades Protection Project, SEP, through Congress in 2011 as an example of the kind of innovative thinking that he thinks is needed to tackle, you know, rising ocean levels, global warming, all that. This project, of course, built on the comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, or SERP, that had been approved more than a decade earlier. Now, you know, I tell you, I've covered Florida politics for a few decades now, and Everglades restoration has been a recurring theme. And in fact, you know, before my time as well, Everglades restoration has been talked about since 1969 is what I found sort of the tipping point. That's 50 years ago, you know, Woodstock and all that. So with some of the real flooding in South Florida communities expected by 2030, that's 11 years away. At this pace, Rubio should acknowledge that he's going to have to, you know, pick up the pace of his adaptation. And if climate change is anything like the state and federal approach to Everglades restoration, you know, everybody in Florida better learn to swim and you know, plan on buying a nice beachfront property, say, you know, maybe somewhere near Orlando. So that's the kind of time frame that we're looking at, how quickly this change could be taking place at this point. And Rubio is sort of, you know, promoting in his editorial this sort of very measured approach that is, to a great extent, you know, maybe politics as usual. And I don't know if people are, you know, willing to accept that.
Yeah, Rubio also says in his op-ed that climate change is, quote, manageable. And he seems to be proceeding under the assumption we can just adapt and adjust to these climate impacts by, you know, changing where we build or how we build or how we do things. But it's worth noting that some experts really believe that a large parts of the country will become almost unlivable or, in fact, unlivable if we keep producing greenhouse gas emissions at the rate that we are. So the idea that you just adapt without trying to limit climate change from getting worse, I think a lot of climate experts would disagree with that. But that is where Rubio's at right now. Okay, well, we're going to move on to our pick a number segment. I'll go first today. My number is 34.2, as in the Florida Chamber of Commerce Foundation's chief economist now says there is a 34.2% chance of Florida experiencing a recession within the next 9 months. That's up from a 20.8% chance of a recession in April. So almost a 50% increase in terms of the chance of a recession now. So the economist for one of the Florida's top business groups is increasingly of the opinion that a recession is looming next year. And obviously a recession is a big deal for a lot of reasons. It's a big deal for workers, business owners. It's a big deal for state government too, which could be forced to cut the budget if tax revenues dip during a recession. So lawmakers watch predictions like this pretty closely, and I think we'll see some very cautious state budget writers when the legislature convenes in January. John, your number is 8. Want to tell us what that means?
Yeah, my 8 too. Yeah, you and I must be looking at our 401ks or something like that, because I've got a recession-related number too. The 8 is actually 8%, negative 8%. Because Florida is still 8% below the state revenue levels that it had reached in 2008. Now, that was right before the recession, and that saw the economy plunge with a sharp retraction in dollars flowing into state government. And it has never come fully back in Florida. That number, negative 8, is from a new study by Pew Charitable Trusts, which examined how the 50 states are doing post-recession. Now, Florida is one of only 10 states that has not climbed above the once robust revenue levels that they had before the recession kicked in. Now everybody is talking about a recession again after a few rocky weeks on the stock market, and that sluggish revenue number might be worth chewing on for a while. Florida's numbers were sky high pre-recession when the housing market was going gangbusters, and of course that was before the state became one of the hardest hit by the housing collapse. And already, though, we're seeing plenty of people worried about, you know, the possibility of that kind of repeat. The big gaudy number that I had picked last week as my pick a number was $867 million. And that's the reduction that's expected in revenue for this year and next year that state economists just came up with when they revised their forecast. Part of that attributed to the economy being quote unquote winded, as one of the forecasters said, likening it to a runner who's nearing the end of a marathon after this long, upswing in the economy. Now that's a reduction in revenue that is still a generally positive economic forecast, but it's clearly, getting darker. And of course, all this has political shadings. With a presidential election year next year, you know that President Trump is concerned that at least one person could lose their job if the economy goes south. And that unfortunate worker may be him.
All right. A couple of gloomy numbers here this week. How's that to end your work week with worries about a recession? It is worth pointing out, though, that as you said, John, the economic forecast is generally, kind of rosy. Even the Florida Chamber of Commerce's chief economist saying that there's a 34% chance of a recession in the next 9 months. That means there's a 66% chance there won't be a recession. So there's been a lot of talk about a recession these days, but it's still no sure thing. So we'll have to see what happens over the next few months here. Well, that wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our production team of Thomas Cordy, Joseph Corzano, and Adam Fish. Thanks to all of you for listening. We're out of here.